Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for August 17th, 2009, and on this week's episode, Ann Nicholson Weber interviews artists from The Light in the Piazza. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, and let's talk theater.
This is Ann Nicholson Weber, and you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. This week, we're talking about the production of Light in the Piazza, which recently opened at Marriott Lincolnshire Theater. And I'm joined by three of the principals, Summer Smart, Max Quinlan, and Mary Ernster. And I wanted to talk not only about this particular production, but also to talk more broadly about acting in musicals, about the skills of the singing actor or the acting singer, depending on how you view yourselves. But to use this show kind of as a case study, let's say, of that. So I guess one way to kind of set a baseline would be to ask each of you whether you have done much straight theater or whether almost all your work has been in the musical theater. So let me just go around, Max.
Most of my work has been in musical theater, but I have done straight theater and TV work as well. So it's been kind of all over the board.
And what straight shows have you done, just to get an idea?
I did Lost in Yonkers, was my first play that I ever did. And then TV, I did an episode of Early Edition that used to be on CBS.
And what's your training?
I actually just graduated recently from the University of Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, and I hold a BFA in musical theater.
Okay. And Summer, what's your answer to that?
It's very similar to Max's answer, actually. I've mostly done musical theater. I have done one straight play. It was a farce, Noises Off. I had a blast.
Oh, yes.
I was very sore.
The Dumb One?
Yeah. Yes, it was an incredible experience. I learned a lot. Have done a little bit of film and dabbled in that, but my true love is musical theater. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
And Mary?
Well, unlike these two young whippersnappers, I've been in this business for 30 years. So
been around the block.
The blocks. All the blocks. And primarily here in Chicago, the careers that people have for that amount of time, you do a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, and thankfully for Chicago's diverse and exciting theater scene, you can do Shakespeare. I've done, you know, Beatrice and Much Ado About Nothing. And I've also done Glinda and The Wizard of Oz for mm-hmm. children. And, you know, lots and lots of musicals, what I call my golden ladies, like Mrs. Anna and The King and I, and Brigadoon, Fiona, things like that. So I've done a little bit of everything, a little commercial work when I was younger. I have a good Midwestern mom face, and uh-huh. I sold a lot of McDonald's and Kellogg's and that kind of stuff. And, you know, you build a career over time, and people just know, you know, what your sort of category is, and you age through that category. I'm now doing all mothers, and
right.
I'll probably end up doing grandmothers eventually. But it's if you commit yourself to the career, acting is acting, whether it's in, there are different dimensions of film acting and stage mm-hmm. acting, but the basic core of it is the same. Mm-hmm. So you just adapt to the media.
Is there any trend in your career in terms of musicals versus non-musicals?
Well, right now, I have a family, so over the last maybe 10 years, I have backed off of theater pretty much and mm-hmm. commercial work pretty exclusively, mm-hmm. just because, you know, I had a family for a reason. I want to focus on them. But as you get older, the good roles, for especially for women, become fewer and farther mm-hmm. apart. Mm-hmm. So that's just a reality.
And that's true both in straight theater and musical
exactly.
theater.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah. Now in maybe 5-10 years, I'll move into those crazy Shakespearean older ladies. Uh-huh. You know, there may be another step, another stage that uh-huh. I move into. But, uh-huh. you know, you kind of just ebb and flow with who you are at the time.
And what the world throws you.
Exactly. And what's available in the market. you know.
I didn't ask you, Summer, about your training.
Oh, yes. I actually graduated in 2005 from Brigham Young University. I was a, I did their music dance theater major, got a BFA in that. And it's one of the few universities in the country that actually has a three-part major where they focus on the singing, the dancing, and the acting. Kind of the goal is to turn out triple threats. So
right.
Still working on that. I'm going to keep working on that.
Right.
I think you're pretty well on your way, dear.
Well, okay. That leads very nicely into one of the things I wanted to ask about, which is the training for musical actors as opposed to straight actors. So, for instance, at Brigham Young, were people who only wanted to do straight acting there? And if so, were they in the same acting classes as you were?
You know, yes and no. The people that were straight acting were the acting track majors, but we did intermix in the classes, absolutely. And I think that added a really good dynamic. It was good to be able to work together and kind of learn from each other's strengths and weaknesses. And I mean, anytime you join a group of actors together, whether they're musical theater primarily or straight theater primarily, you're going to have a really incredible learning experience.
But again, just to be really clear, were there acting classes specifically for the people in your program, or was it just one track of acting classes that everybody did?
There were certainly acting classes for just us that were music theater based that acting track students didn't need to take. They could if they wanted to.
So that suggests, which is again part of what I'm very interested in trying to dig down into, that there is a concept of acting being somehow different, the job of the actor being different if you're in the musical theater. Is that right?
Well, and I will say the reason that those ones were more exclusive is because they involved the music. Mm-hmm. If you have a student who's primarily an acting track major and they don't sing, period,
right,
then they're not going to get much out of that class. I don't know that I necessarily agree that there's a huge difference. I think there's been that perception for a long time, but it's something that I feel like I want to try to continue to break down because at the heart of it, it's like I said, at the heart of it is the same.
It all comes from the same, what's the word I want, source.
Yeah, it's that core.
One thing that is clearly, well, there are two things that just are obviously different about musical theater acting. And one is you have to negotiate the transition into song, which is something that an actor never has to do. And the other is that you're necessarily in a world that is somehow stylized, because in fact, out on the street, people don't break into song. So there's the whole world of musical theater has its own rules in that way. So I guess I'm interested, Max, in maybe asking you let's talk about the transition from acting to song. Am I right that that's even an issue? Is it something you think about? Is it something you worry about?
I think that most songs in shows for different characters, they come out of, you know, an emotion that's about to happen that is so big and so large that it's more than just speaking, it's singing. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the things that's actually like beautifully done in The Light in the Piazza. And in one of Mary's numbers in the second act, it so smoothly goes from dialogue into song. Mm-hmm. And it almost comes out of nowhere that she starts singing. Mm-hmm. And also, at the end of the song, it kind of comes out of nowhere that she starts talking again, and there's no real beginning and no real end to the musical piece, even though it's there. I think that the emotion gets so heightened that she has no choice but to break into song because that's where it takes her. And I think that that's, you know, where you would want all songs to kind of stem from. You want them to stem from true emotion, but emotion that is so large and almost bigger than yourself that you have to break into, you know, music in order to really translate it and, you know, communicate it to the audience.
Let's just listen for a minute to a snippet from the end of Act One, which is a duet between Fabrizio and Clara, which I think is a good example of that. It's a big love duet.
I think I hear the sound of rattling horns
So that beautiful music is part of the finale of Act One. I'd be interested in talking about those sections that are wordless with the two of you just moving in parallel. What did that mean to you? Why do you think the composer did that, or how did you work on it, or what is there to say about that?
Do you want to go ahead?
Sure. first of all, the ahs in different sections of that song are extremely difficult musically. Mm-hmm. We rehearse it over and over again to really get them as solid as they need to be for the song to sound as beautiful as it's written. But, you know, the big thing that happens between Fabrizio and Clara, I think, throughout the show is them finding a way to communicate with each other that nobody else really seems to understand. Mm-hmm. And they have a language barrier between the two of them, you know, with Fabrizio speaking in Italian primarily and Clara not understanding the language as much. So I think that the ahs are extremely well put into that song. And if you look at the scene before that song takes place, that's what the whole scene is about. You know, they have these very strong feelings that they're not really knowing how to communicate to one another. Mm-hmm. And the only way that they can is through that song. And, you know, sometimes they say things to each other in the piece, and then sometimes words aren't even enough and they need more than that. And the fact that they connect on this, you know, the simplest thing of just saying, ah, but they're in unison and perfect unison and these hard intervals, but they're together the entire time. It really shows, you know, how much the characters have united and how much they're one and how much they're meant for each other. Mm. And it really, I think it takes the whole relationship to the next level that it needs to be at for the audience to follow it.
Just as Max was saying, I think it's that whole language of the heart, mm-hmm. Which I think is a really strong theme in this show. Yeah. It's something that exists and it's strong and not, there's no way to really explain it, but you know it's there. It's that language that exists between people, that feeling. And I think, as he was saying about the scene beforehand, there's a moment where she says, I always understand. Mm-hmm. And to me, that kind of is that just kind of wraps up the whole point of that scene and the song that follows. You know, it's they're understanding each other without needing words.
Right.
And that line, I always understand, is actually the musical cue for the song to begin before we even start singing. There's still dialogue that happens, but that's the musical cue mm-hmm. for the orchestra to enter. Mm-hmm. So that's that third language of love coming in.
Well, and I think, too, as I think about it now, it didn't hit me exactly at the time, but they're also just beginning to explore a physical relationship where words are kind of irrelevant. I mean,
it
seems to fit with this idea that they're moving into a sensual connection, too.
And I remember the first time that I saw this scene, I saw it when the touring company came through, and it hit me that the way that the intervals are written, the way the music is written, it's as if someone takes those excited, insecure, wonderful, amazing feelings of that kind of a situation and just put them in music. And the way it's timed, the way it's written, the specific notes that were chosen, it's as if someone literally takes those and just puts them on the outside and lets everyone else hear them musically. At least for me, that was the experience that I had. I don't know if that's...
It's beautiful.
Well, I hope that we're communicating that. I truly hope that.
Well, the other thing in this... when you sing a song, the music has a lot of meaning, and particularly emotional meaning, which when you're just speaking dialogue, in a sense, you create as an actor. It seems to me as if, in a way, the music, I wouldn't say is dictatorial, but is very specific in a way that maybe dialogue isn't always.
When you put the medium of film and compare it to musical theater, there is underscoring in a film.
Right.
And there is often underscoring in a straight play.
Right.
That underscoring is the heartbeat of the story. It takes you on an emotional ride.
Right.
Whether there's songs in the story or whether it's all dialogue, but there is usually music somewhere in the play, on stage, in a film, in musicals. And that is the heart song. That's what's going through and guiding the audience to the emotional state they need to be for the story to ring.
Now, sometimes I can feel with underscoring in a straight play kind of annoyed that I'm being told how to feel, that the music is, I don't know.
A distraction?
Well, yeah, and maybe limiting or trying to manipulate my response.
Do you feel that way in film as well?
Yes, sometimes, actually. Well, particularly a score that I don't think works. I mean, if you don't, then it just becomes distracting. You don't want to be thinking about the music. But with in musical theater, of course, it's the point. I mean, it would to say that the music is manipulative would kind of
say, why are you there then?
Right, exactly. So I don't know what I have to say about that, just that it's a kind of an interesting contrast. Well, let's talk about acting a song. And Mary, maybe talk with you a minute since I've been talking to the other two about the duet. And maybe use the example that Max was talking about.
You talking about The Beauty Is?
Mm-hmm. The Beauty Is, right.
It really is telling a story. That particular piece is not written in song form, mm-hmm. you know, like the first verse and then you sing the second verse.
Right.
Yeah. It's like a through-sung opera recitative, basically, mm-hmm. that then goes into a more melodic phase. But it's basically telling the story of the guilt that the mother feels, that Margaret feels from the accident that caused the brain injury for Claire in the first place. That's the whole sort of secret behind this story. So there's no, you know, song form that really worked to tell that story. You have to just lay out the emotions. She's laying out a feeling of longing. And the piece begins with her actually speaking the story to the audience, beginning the story, what really happened that day. Mm-hmm. And then as Margaret creates the images for the audience, the music sort of seeps in and lifts the story onto a form that is much more heightened emotion.
Mm-hmm.
But I find within the song, the challenge for the performer, for me, is to hold on to the emotion and still be able to sing it. I mean, you can abandon your scruples and just cry and wail in front of the audience, but it's never going to influence them as profoundly as if you hold on to your emotions.
Well, not to mention you can't sing if you're choked
physically,
up.
Physically true. That is true. Uh-huh. But the challenge for me in that song is to hold on and get the story out and sing the high notes at the end.
Well, talk about how you prepare a song differently than you might a monologue. Suppose that were just a monologue. I mean, obviously you have to learn the notes and you have to get it in your voice vocally, and that's a big deal. But is there anything different about the way you approach acting it or not?
No, it pretty much is approached the same way as you would a monologue. Mm-hmm. You, although usually, for me, I learn the music first, just the melodies, the rhythms. I learn it mechanically first. Mm-hmm. Then I go back and I learn it as a monologue, and then I put the two together. Mm-hmm. Because physically, I just train vocally in such a way that I need to get the notes placed in the proper way to sound good, and then you can fill it from underneath with the emotion.
And when you're doing the second stage of what you just described, where you're working on it now as an acting piece, do you sing it, or do you ever just speak it and act it?
Sometimes I speak it, you know. But for me, you know, I've sort of over the years dovetailed those two techniques where I don't separate it so much anymore. Mm-hmm. I used to a lot more when I was studying or when I need a coaching or something. I will separate it like that. But, you know, you kind of begin to know yourself and you know where you need to do this and do that.
You don't need to split it up so much.
Yeah.
Max, you're from you said you trained at the Cincinnati Conservatory, which suggests that you really began as a musician. Is that true or not?
I actually began as a performer first, but the school that I went to just happened to be a conservatory that had a great musical theater program within it.
Uh-huh. So is your process any different from what Mary describes?
You know, I think that when you're looking at the approach of a monologue versus the approach of a song, I think it's always actually the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a quote that I always use from Liza Minnelli, actually, who gave an interview once that she said that she never considered herself a singer. She always considered herself a storyteller.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's what your job is. I think that's what your job is when you're doing a monologue. It's when you're in a scene. And I think that, you know, when you're looking at a song, a lot of times, you know, even at school, it was used as an exercise to take the lyrics out and put them together as a monologue mm-hmm. and just, you know, approach it in that way. And it's amazing how when you approach a song in that way and you don't know the music necessarily first, and then you hear what the sound is, the words that, you know, have the emphasis behind it, the orchestration support that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, more rarely you would find a song that the orchestrations don't, you have to like play against what the music is doing in order to tell the story. And I think that's why it's a lot of times very important to approach a song just as you would approach a monologue and not let the music influence you necessarily. Because the story is the important thing, not the musicality of it, not how beautiful you sound. Uh-huh. It's the words you're saying and getting to the end point but still starting where you need to.
Well, that partly answers what I was going to ask next, which is what does it really mean to say you're telling a story, you prepare this song as a story. So you're saying one thing it means is that if the music might push you in a different direction in terms of emphasis, for instance, mm-hmm. you resist that because that matters less.
Yeah, I think you definitely have to play against the music a lot of time. You know, even in the song that we were just discussing, the music is so beautiful and so lush, and it's so easy as a performer to get lost in that.
That's seduced by it, yeah.
Yeah, and to just go there and mm-hmm. bawl and let the music take over you, but you can't because your job is to tell the story.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and by doing that and sticking with, you know, what the script is and what the lines are and what the dialogue is, I think that's when the audience can meet you halfway, and that's when they can feel true emotion, is when you're just allowing the story to be told and not like pushing the emotion on them.
Well, let's talk quickly about one more number, because what you're talking about really triggers it, makes me think about that, which is an aria you have, All in Italian, mm-hmm. which is one of the most abandoned, just...
boy in love!
Exactly. I mean, it's just so out there and huge and just completely uninhibited, which is how you performed it, and it was gorgeous. And that, given what you've just said, must be a very challenging number to appear so abandoned and yet somehow to be... What? Remaining objective in some way, remaining.
Yeah, I think
do it in Italian.
And do it in Italian. Yeah.
Right.
I think that song is it's a very interesting piece because, first of all, I mean, the challenge of singing in Italian and making sure that the audience is still following your story, it's taking that level of acting to the next level and challenging mm-hmm. you even more.
Right.
But the main thing that was important to me was to memorize the song in Italian, obviously, but mm-hmm. also to memorize it in English and know exactly what I was saying, mm-hmm. exactly where the story was going. Mm-hmm. And that song is so big and is so freeing as, you know, as a performer. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a very easy song to get caught up in vocally and just mm-hmm. let yourself go. You know, some of the words that are really being said in the song are beautiful and almost heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, he's saying that he didn't feel alive until this person came into his life, basically. Mm-hmm. Like he had nothing and he was in the darkness, and she's this light that has, you know, allowed him to live. And those are extremely strong words. And if you can imagine saying that in English, like it's extremely strong.
Right.
And, you know, to make sure that the audience gets how much he's really feeling is very important to the piece. Mm-hmm. But also making sure that, you know, the end is where it needs to be and the middle is where it needs to be and the beginning is where it needs to be.
So what does that mean, though, that in terms of what?
I mean, when I start the song, you know, the first line is talking about the fact that he feels like he's been in the dark this whole time, mm-hmm. that his life hasn't really started, basically, until meeting this person. And I think that's exactly how the song starts musically. The orchestrations support that idea perfectly. Mm-hmm. It comes in as more of, you know, at pianissimo, it starts
kind of
very quiet and,
mm-hmm.
it's very like to himself and realizing these things, like these things that he didn't even know about himself until meeting this person.
Mm-hmm. So he's discovering these emotions through the course of the song.
Right.
Uh-huh. What is the role of the music director versus the conductor in helping you to prepare the music?
Well, this process was a little different in that that we had a musical director and a conductor for the orchestra as well. Mm-hmm. And both of the gentlemen who helped us with this piece are extremely, extremely talented musicians. And they do play different roles.
Did the conductor coach you at all, or did he? Yes.
Well,
no?
Not as he did. Yeah, it depended on.
It depends.
Michael Duff is the conductor. Mm-hmm. He's also been a musical director for shows So he has those skills. And during a rehearsal process, you know, everybody's working so hard at different times in different rooms. And when you get assigned, I'm going to work on this song with Michael playing piano, because mm-hmm. he actually did all the piano accompaniment uh-huh. during rehearsals. And then Ryan is in the other room with another issue rehearsing this. You get the blessings of both men.
Absolutely.
At yeah. different times. Mm-hmm. They both are incredibly astute musicians and have different sensibilities. Michael has an emotional sensibility that's quite unique and wonderful and loving.
Yes.
And whereas Ryan's is more orchestral and what's the word? Disciplined. He has mm-hmm. he didn't allow us to indulge our musician, our vocalness. Uh-huh. You know, at
so
the beginning
loving
of the
your
song.
Own voice.
Exactly. Right. Uh-huh. He knew he has the ability to register where it needs to go mm-hmm. and when.
Mm-hmm. It's unusual to have two.
Yes,
normally the music director would also conduct, right?
Unusual, but I think very necessary in this particular piece. Mm-hmm. It was a quick process and a very challenging one, and you're dealing with loving the material so much and wanting to give it what it deserves, and it was extremely helpful to have both of these incredible men working with us.
How long was the rehearsal process?
2 weeks.
Aha. Wow.
Yes, an extreme challenge on this particular piece. I think mm-hmm. you can maybe put together, I don't know, I don't want to be disparaging, but Joseph, you could do it in 2 weeks. Uh-huh. This show, we would have loved to have had a little more time, but, you know. Yeah.
So that means you have to have come in pretty much off book, and right? I mean, you can't.
That's mm-hmm. an interesting topic. You know, it's funny trying to find your system. With this particular mm-hmm. show, I tried to come in, but at the same time, I had never met Mary. Right. I'd worked with Max briefly, and I didn't want to come in with something set.
Exactly.
And then not be able to let it conform mm-hmm. to the
right.
you know,
being
the magic
responsive.
Of the relationship.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's difficult.
But on the other hand, to try to memorize the music,
right.
the dialogue, the blocking, and put this show together in 2 weeks doesn't seem possible.
I think you try to come in with the technical aspects down, and then we
right.
take what really matters and develop the emotion of the piece.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And it's a very difficult score, I think. Is that right?
Extremely.
Both vocally in terms of big ranges and big leaps, and also musically just in terms of sometimes surprising melodic structures, mm-hmm. intervals, whatever.
I found the rhythmic aspect of this show extremely yeah. challenging.
Extremely. Mm-hmm.
Adam writes music that is unpredictable, and you are often singing on the downbeat while the orchestra is emphasizing the offbeat, mm-hmm. and you don't ever, a lot of times you don't feel like you're with the orchestra, but you are doing what is written.
Well, that is very operatic. I mean, that makes me think of mm-hmm. Verdi. Or,
well, true. Very true. I think Adam has a, I mean, well, he's gifted in that he's Richard Rodgers' grandson.
Right, that's a fun thing
But
to
I
know.
Think his musical training was quite profound.
Rigorous,
and
yeah.
he mm-hmm. has some tricks in his bag beyond the usual songwriter.
Oh, mm-hmm. yes.
Well, I have heard the piece called operatic. Do you agree with that?
I think that it's very similar. I mean, I think that it's kind of, it's a modern day opera. Is what, how I would describe it. And I think that it's kind of the direction I hope that opera actually starts becoming.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the piece, you know, when you look at the piece, the music is very operatic and very difficult, but the script is a play in itself. And the script is gorgeous, and the scenes
yeah.
are amazing. And and I think it's very rare that a musical has such a great book. And yet has such a great score.
Amen. Well, and the book is written by a very serious playwright. Greg
exactly.
Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Leonardo, our director, actually said several times throughout the course of the rehearsal process that we were doing a play with music,
mm-hmm.
which I agree with 100%. It is. It's a play, and it's about the story. And every musical, every piece of theater should be that. As Max said, it should be about the story.
Mm-hmm.
But with this one in particular, you just feel it's so important. It's so important to keep it honest in order to give the audience the true heart of the story. And I think that has been very important to each of us. There's been I think each of us, I know myself, have put a lot of pressure on ourselves to make sure we're honest in the story because we believe in it so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that's striking about it, it's because Craig Lucas is such, I think, a beautiful writer. It's very sophisticated writing. It is unusually sophisticated writing for musical theater. And you don't think about that when you're in the musical theater. But when you go to a piece that is informed by, you know, a dramatic playwright's sensibility, you do feel the difference, I think. Which is, I think, why I object to characterizing it as opera. Because to me, opera is music first and foremost. And if you look at historically how it's been performed by people who really can't act, that's less and less true. But certainly what makes an opera singer is the pipes first, and then you get pushed around the stage. and as I say, that's less true. But to me, this is very much about the drama, even though the score is very sophisticated and very difficult. Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe we should refer to it as a musical theater piece. I don't know what the best description for
this
is.
It's a unique piece. Uh-huh. It's unlike any other, so I think that's why we're having a difficult time putting a tag on it.
Categorized.
Well, let's talk about one more aspect of it, which is that it's a new piece, a relatively new piece, so that unlike most musical theater that you're likely to have done, it hasn't been done 1,000 times, you haven't seen it 1,000 times, many different performers haven't done their take on it. Does that change your job? Does that change how you approached it or how you felt about it?
I don't know. Not really, because the task at hand is still the same. I guess you can get the movie version of Guys and Dolls and see what
Marlon Brando did. Maybe
and
not.
See if there's something you want to steal. But
right.
There, this is such a rich piece, and it's freeing to not have somebody's stamp on it.
Right.
Although, there were some pretty profound performances of this.
Did you see the New York production?
No, I never saw. I saw the PBS Lincoln Center. They did a live performance broadcast of it, which I saw a long time ago. But it was, on TV, so I never got to, rewind.
Right. It just came and went, right?
Yes, exactly.
Right. Max, had you seen it before?
I did see it in New York, actually. Luckily enough, I actually saw it just kind of on a whim and got a ticket. And one of my favorite performers that I look up to is Aaron Lazar, who played Fabrizio, who was playing it at the time. And so I really wanted to get a chance to see him in the role, and he had went to my school, so I knew I knew a lot about him. So it was an honor to see the show, and I was blown away by it.
And so then you're carrying that performance in your mind when you find out that you're doing it. How does that affect you?
A little bit. I mean, I think that it affected me a lot less in this show than any other that I've ever approached, really. And I guess what you were bringing up before of, not a lot of people have seen this piece. And for me as an audience member personally, I love going into a show knowing nothing.
Right.
And if I could do that every time I'd see a show, I would. And it was nice to not have a structure. It was nice to not have someone to live up to or to not have a name that comes along with the show. I mean, I just got done doing Joseph, and I can't tell you how many interviews it was like, so Donny Osmond,
which is great.
And Donny Osmond was fantastic in the show. Uh-huh. But a lot of the interviews were actually asking, do you think of his performance in order to get to yours?
Are you trying to play Donny's performance, right?
And it's so nice and freeing to do a show that doesn't have that element to it.
But that's other people's minds. They're thinking about Donny, but now you had seen this performance that you really admired. So I still want to know, is there something you have to exercise, to not, try to remember how he did it or I don't know. What happens to an actor when you've got that in your head?
Well, I mean, when I saw La in the Piazza, it was so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I think that when I left the theater, I was just so moved by the play and couldn't tell you what he did in every moment. And when I first got the script and was reading it, I don't remember specific things that he did. I just remember loving his performance.
Right.
And so
you're
when
not
I
haunted, yeah.
Yeah, when yeah, I approached
that's a real
it
trap to find yourself in thinking, "Oh wow, I really liked the way he turned his head at that point."
Right.
And you try to do the same thing
and it doesn't work.
It lays flat like an egg, 'cause it's not you.
It's not you, right? Just on a completely different topic, are there cliches in the theater world about the differences between musical theater actors and straight actors? Like if you did satire, what would be the characteristics that people would satirize?
I think there's all sorts of satire out there about musical theater. I don't know how much of it is true. I think it's evolved a lot. You know, I mean, if you think of just in general, people say, oh, cheesy musical theater, which drives me batty because it's against everything we try to do. It's not cheesy. It's real. But I don't know. What would you say, Mary?
No, I think there's some stigma to, you know, people who can't sing will color it in a certain way.
Sour grapes, you're saying.
But that's, you know, that's only in, you know, small cases. It's not the pervasive thing. I think that there are so many friends of mine through my career that don't do musicals that then are cast in one for whatever reason, if they're playing a non-singing role or they're playing a role that just barely sings.
You can walk through
Right. Mm-hmm. They almost always come to me and go, I didn't realize how difficult this was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And vocally, it's just you have to keep your chops. You have to vocalize daily in order to keep your skills toned. Mm-hmm. And it's just a discipline you have to accept if you're going to have a career in it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you all three for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for having
thank
us.
Thank you.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of August 17th, 2009. Drury Lane Theater, Oakbrook Terrace, has announced its exciting 2010 season, featuring five smash hit productions. These musicals include the Tony Award-winning classic Ragtime, directed by Rachel Rockwell, and that will open on March 24th and run through May 23rd of next year. Next is the 1959 Marilyn Monroe film Some Like It Hot, turned into a musical named Sugar. Sugar will be directed by Jim Corti and opens on June 9th and runs through August 1st. After that will be the timeless comedy Hot Mikado. This one is directed by David H. Bell. It opens on August 18th and runs through October 3rd. Following that will be Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. It will be directed by Bill Jenkins, opens on October 20th and runs through December 19th. And then the season's much-anticipated grand finale. It'll be the Chicago regional premiere of the Monty Python-inspired farce, Spamalot. It'll be directed by Drury Lane Oakbrook Artistic Director William Ossetek and will open on January 6th, 2011. For more information on the complete Drury Lane Theater Oakbrook Terrace 2010 season, click on over to theaterinchicago.com. Benno Nelson gives us another edition in his Full Storefrontal series. His latest article features artistic director James Palmer of the Red Tape Theater Company in Lakeview. They discuss the company's beginnings, the Red Tape Theater's outlook, and their long-term goals for the future. Check out Benno Nelson's latest article on Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank our guests for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And I would also like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.